Hello, and thank you for joining us for this episode of Nation of Writers. This podcast is presented in conjunction with our new virtual exhibit, American Voices, which you can explore at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we'll discuss the life and work of Nora Ephron, one of the most popular, accomplished, and beloved writers in American journalism and film. Best known for iconic rom-com films like When Harry Met Sally, Sleepless in Seattle, You've Got Mail, and more, Ephron was also a reporter, essayist, director, and novelist who brought her trademark wit and humor to all aspects of her writing, and revolutionized journalism, comedy, and film in the process. Today we are joined by Kristen Marguerite Doige, an award-winning journalist, professor, and speaker based in Los Angeles, and author of the forthcoming Nora Ephron, a biography. Her writing has been featured in The Atlantic, Marie Claire, Fortune, Bustle, The Los Angeles Review of Books, and The Los Angeles Business Journal, among other publications. Kristen teaches journalism and public relations at Loyola Marymount University. Nora Ephron, a biography, will be released by Chicago Review Press on June 7th. Doige is interviewed by Nate King, digital content associate for the American Writers Museum.
Well, hi, Kristen. Thanks for joining me today on the Nation of Writers podcast. Excited to talk about Nora Ephron with you. Your book, Nora Ephron, a biography, comes out in June, yes?
June 7th. Yes, it's almost June. Here.
Wow. All right. Well, first, before we get into it, I guess, could you tell me a little bit about yourself and how you know, what you've been up to, how you came across Nora's work and got started on the book a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks so much for having me. Always excited to talk about Nora's life and work. And I'm really obviously wholly focused on that right now for the summer and fall. I am an adjunct professor at Loyola Marymount University, where I teach journalism and public relations. Like most writers, I, of course, have started to think about what my next project might be, which I'm hoping will be another biography. But it's really wonderful to kind of get to see Nora getting her due. Not that she didn't before, but it's a really fun part of the writing process to actually get to share it with the world.
Yeah, I love that. What prompted you, I guess, to start working on this Nora Ephron biography?
Yeah. So, you know, like most kids who grew up in the 80s and 90s, I knew of her movies, but I hadn't really directly encountered her work until I was in college. Particularly when I was a grad student, I was trying to find an interesting topic for my master's thesis. And I had become interested in this idea of why there was kind of this crisis, as it was being called, in marriage, that, you know, marriage rates had gone down quite a bit. And what's that about? And so I became curious about that. And at the same time, knew I wanted to write about possibly a female director. And then it suddenly became very clear, I know it should be Nora Ephron. And what I didn't know until I started doing more research was that she had been a journalist long before she became a filmmaker. And so she had started as a reporter at the New York Post in the early 60s. And so you realize that there's just this whole treasure trove of information about this extraordinary woman long before she became the beloved filmmaker that most of us knew her to be later in life. So I just became fascinated. And after, you know, the 9 to 12 months of working on the thesis project, I just felt like there was so much more to know and so many more stories to tell. And so I thought, you know, this should become a book. I couldn't believe that there wasn't really a biography about Nora Ephron. You know, she left us in 2012. So at the time, you know, it had only been a few years. And there are some wonderful other books about Nora and her work. But really, there hadn't been an actual biography written yet. And I just thought that was crazy. And I thought I humbly, naively going to try my best to honor her and her work and, you know, see if we could basically make it possible for even more people to fall in love with her as I did.
I love that as an approach to a book. Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to reading it myself. I've been a big Nora Ephron fan, so mm-hmm. Those rom-com were like kind of my first, like, you know, first times being like, oh wow, look at this romance. And I watched them as I think I was in high school and college is when I first saw them, and I was like, oh wow, look at that, like I want to fall in love like that too. And I love how you a lot of her films, I guess, are about falling in love or the, you know, on the surface level, obviously. But I love how you said you wanted people to fall in love with her too.
Well, yes, I love that. I love, first of all, the fact that, you know, she's writing in a genre, obviously, that's a lot of times associated with women, you know, the mm-hmm. chick flick, if you will, you know. Yeah. And obviously, we know this goes back to, you know, literature and this idea of, you know, romance novels and that kind of thing being associated with women. But I love that, you know, she did have such a unique, smart, witty approach to, she could kind of stand back and also say, like, this is why it's funny that we all get sappy and silly watching these movies. And I always love hearing men, how they connect with her and her stories as well. And to your point, she wrote about love, and she wrote about love in the movies, but it wasn't just about marriage or, you know, our traditional ideas of, you know, heterosexual, you know, romance. I mean, really kind of the point of my thesis was also about falling in love with journalism, you know, and falling in love with food. She absolutely adored food. Falling in love with the idea that you can have a lifelong professional and personal partnership with your sister, which she had with Delia. And these are just really wonderful, beautiful things. And I really have become fascinated with that. And I think it's something that makes her unique, that it wasn't just about, you know, like, obviously, she's best known for her writing about relationships with men and women, but that, like you said, I mean, she could fall in love with, you know, a hot dog. I mean, she just thought that, you know, I mean, she was so passionate in the way she lived and so joyful that, you know, you couldn't help but, you know, kind of start to, you know, take some of that on.
Yeah. I love that. That just made me think, I think I saw a quote of hers that was something like, you can never have too much butter. If that's the religion I have, or something like that.
Yes, yes, yes. Yes, exactly. Exactly. No, I mean, that's what I mean. Her quotes are kind of what drew me into her, because, you know, she has so many of those really memorable, wonderful one-liners. And that's truly how she talks, and it's how she writes, you know. So it's like, wow. Yeah, it's really unbelievable. And she felt that her mother said that, and also Julia Child said that, and I think that it is the perfect philosophy for her and for life, because she felt like, why not, you know, why not?
Exactly. Yeah. I like that. You've brought up so many things I want to get into, but first I'd love to hear, I think you have a passage from the biography that I'd love to hear before we get into it.
Sure. So I was going to read a little bit from my author's note at the front.
Awesome.
And so it's entitled, Why Nora Ephron Still Matters. All roads lead to Nora. I have said this many times over the years as I dug into the life and work of Nora Ephron, first as a graduate student and later as a reporter. When I first came across a quote from Nora's 1996 Wellesley commencement speech, don't be frightened, you can always change your mind. I know, I've had 4 careers and 3 husbands. I wondered, how could this fascinating woman have been the same person who wrote both the scathing novel Heartburn and the warm and earnest film Sleepless in Seattle? The answer, as her dear friend and longtime collaborator, Diane Dreyer, said to me, she would always surprise you. During the past 7 years I spent working on this book, one way or another, an inevitable connection to Nora would emerge. An actor or actress she'd worked with early on or who'd sought her advice or counsel, a writer she'd mentored, a book or a show she'd adapted or had ultimately inspired. For some recent examples, see such diverse productions as Ted Lasso, Only Murders in the Building, and Succession. But one of the most delicious things about writing a biography, as Nora might have put it, is that you're still living your own life right alongside the person you're studying, learning about, and writing about. As you change and grow and evolve, so too does your understanding of what that person went through in various stages of her life, and how she must have felt when she faced decisions, both small and large, as a feminist, filmmaker, foodie, writer, friend, sister, daughter, wife, and mother. And so, you know, there's a little more that I go through there. But as I sort of wrapped up this section, I just said, as you rewatch her films, read or reread her essays and articles, and consider her unique point of view, you might find that many, if not all, roads worth taking somehow lead back to Nora. She called on us to make a little trouble on behalf of women. And I hope this book will help galvanize us all to be a little braver and to order more than one dessert.
That's lovely. That's great.
Thank you.
Yeah. One thing that I, like you said too, was surprised to learn, I guess, or I guess I just didn't know it about her, is her early career as starting as a journalist and the sort of trials that she went through as a woman journalist in the 60s, right? Is that the, am I getting the time frame? Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'd love to hear more about that period of her life. And also I studied journalism myself in college. So I'd love to hear your thoughts as a journalist yourself, and also one who, you know, now you teach it. How learning that about Nora Ephron has impacted your own life as well?
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the great things about Nora was that she truly was who she was from the time she was a toddler. She was making sort of funny, witty remarks as a little girl at preschool, and her parents absolutely thought she was the best thing since sliced bread. They just thought she was hilarious. And she was sort of written into their first hit play on Broadway, which was called Three's a Family, which ran on Broadway in 1943. So she's only two at this point, and she's already inspiring material. So, so, you know, she really, you know, her parents were playwrights. They became screenwriters later, when they came here to Los Angeles. And so she really thought she was rebelling by becoming a reporter. While she was in high school, she would do dispatches for the LA Times, for, you know, she was covering, I think, girls basketball at the time. And of course she wrote for her school paper, and then, same thing at Wellesley College. She was a political science major. And so she was really interested in the issues of the day. And so she and her fellow troublemakers, as she would call them, at the Wellesley News, you know, covered a lot of really important issues of the day, and really wanted to call attention to things, even if it, you know, kind of caused some friction with the administration, while she was there. So, you know, she really had already begun to make a name for herself as far as being someone who wasn't afraid, you know, to call out things that weren't right or weren't just or weren't fair. And of course, all of this is in the backdrop of the civil rights movement and, you know, the beginnings of, you know, the women's rights movement and all of that. And so she would get frustrated at times that with people who she perceived were not sort of bold enough to kind of question these things and call them out. And so she went from Wellesley to New York, as she had always kind of dreamt of doing. And
yeah, I read that she wanted to be like a Dorothy Parker, right?
Absolutely. She was very, very inspired by Dorothy Parker. She loved the fact that she was sort of the only woman at the table.
Yeah.
You know, that she always managed to get the perfect one-liner in her mind. But she also was, again, eager to hone her craft. And so she started as a mail girl, as they were called in those days at Newsweek, and was quickly promoted to a clipper, which basically means that you were in charge of reading all of the newspapers from all over the country and pulling important information or research for the reporters, who, of course, were at the time were all men, save for maybe one exception. So she really, you know, being the great student that she was, she had skipped a grade and she graduated valedictorian from Beverly Hills High. She took this opportunity to learn, you know, to read every paper and to really understand, you know, what the things are that contribute to a good story. And so she went from there to the New York Post after meeting Victor Navasky and being hired to write a sort of parody of the New York Post called the New York Pest during the time that there was a newspaper strike in New York. And what's really fascinating about this is that a new style of writing really started to emerge around that time, partially because of the fact that there really weren't as many writing jobs in daily newspapers. So this is where this style of writing came kind of to prominence. I mean, there's lots of debate about this because this is something that predated the 60s. But in the 60s, we started to see these magazine writers who were showing us how to understand the news. So here's how we can contextualize and better understand this, even though it happened a month ago. So, you know, you can see these longer lead times giving them also time to kind of think through and process, okay, this is in the context of X, Y, and Z, and here's how we should think about it. And so you started to see, you know, writers like Jimmy Breslin and Gay Talese and Joan Didion and Nora really starting to say, I can have a voice about this, as opposed to sort of the traditional newspaper writing and reporting of, you know, quote unquote objectivity, which again would be something that she would kind of scoff at because there is no such thing as objectivity. Yeah.
It's impossible.
That's right.
Yeah, that's, like I said, that part of her career was fascinating to me on the one hand, because I hadn't heard about it before, but also just her, you know, how involved she was in those movements that you listed. And I think it comes full even in her films, you know, her female characters are so whole and real. And I think especially in that genre, they, you know, she goes way below the surface of her characters. And I'm wondering if you could see in your research, like how her early career kind of led to what perhaps, you know, what she's best known for now. But, you know, obviously, you know, I wonder if there's like one single line that you can pull through her work as a whole.
Yes.
I know is a tough question because there's a lot of work there.
No, it's true, but it's also a great question because she was a reporter through and through her entire life. She was an observer, you know, she was always taking notes, whether she was like literally physically taking notes or if she was just noticing, you know. Right. I was having a really wonderful discussion the other day with a woman who is an assistant editor on two of her films. And she was saying she saw you, you know, and she said you didn't know or notice necessarily that she saw you, but then she just knew things, you know, and was so specific and thoughtful with her gifts for people and things like that. And so obviously you can think about on a film set when there's all these people to, you know, manage and to oversee, you know, all the various moving parts when you're a director, she was still able to use those skills as a reporter to, you know, be really successful and to have a really unique approach to filmmaking. And the other thing that's really cool and interesting about Nora is she refused to ever take herself too seriously or to take any kind of political movement too seriously. And so she just thought that there should always be some way of understanding it in a funny way that would help us get through it. So even though the women's movement was happening and it was serious and people were burning bras and all these things, she was kind of like, no one is writing about this with any humor. And it's kind of funny, you know, it's kind of funny that we both want these things and we don't want these things, you know? And so she just kind of always had that way of conceptualizing things for all of us so that we could understand. And so I think that's just one of her best skills. And again, she learned this at a very, very young age that, you know, around the dinner table, the Efron dinner table, her parents, especially her father, would say, that's a funny line, write that down. And so, you know, she kind of really honed that idea over years and years and years, and it definitely stuck with her. We can see it, of course, in her best-selling essay collections later in life, I Remember Nothing and Other Reflections, and I Feel Bad About My Neck. And both of those are just absolutely hilarious. If you open them to any page, you'll just instantly start cracking up. So, you know, even, you know, talking about aging and death and dying, she knew when things were obviously poignant. And it wasn't that she didn't, again, take the thing seriously that should be taken seriously, like, you know, making sure she brought in her films on time and on budget and things like that. But she also just refused to do anything that wasn't also, in her mind, fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that. Yeah. Cause I mean, you can take care of business and be mm-hmm. serious, but you might as well have some fun with it while you're doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And little things, you know, I mean, like one of the cool things about her, you know, and again, I don't know if this is specific to being a woman, you know, on a film set, but what's cool about it, cause I know she would not like that, but, but what's cool about the Nora Ephron film set is, again, she would just notice things that the rest of us kind of maybe would just think, well, that's just how it is. And she would say, like, does this wire really have to be here? Cause I keep having to step over it and it's really doesn't look nice. And like, you know, do these carrots really have to be so sad? I'd like for them to actually look like carrots at the craft services table. You know, these little tiny things that you're thinking, you know, do these things really matter? But it's like, of course they do. All of these little things, you know, add up to, you know, just a really brilliant, wonderful time. And so I think that she was always, always paying attention again to those small details and things that really just open your mind up to what's possible. It's like, oh, I didn't even know that I could ask that we move that wire, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's great. In a similar vein of her noticing things and kind of always having that reporter mentality, as you were doing your research, did you start noticing things about her that either surprised you or impressed you, inspired you, anything that sort of, moved you in any sort of way that you didn't know prior to writing this book?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Tons. It's really interesting. I think the relationship with her parents, her very complicated, but ultimately really special bond that she had with her mother, whom she lost when she was only 30 years old. Nora was only 30. And the impact of Phoebe, her mother, on her life and work can't be overstated. And that was, I don't want to say a surprise, but it was just the ways that that came out in her writing and in her projects. Really stood out to me because, you know, we're all getting older and our parents are getting older. And, you know, I really was moved by that because it's hard. It's hard to be a daughter of parents who were one way at one time and then were not anymore. And that's really how her household was. You know, she has these wonderful memories of growing up in a very happy, joyful, sort of noisy household with lots of love and parties and writers and great conversations and great food, to also being, you know, 14 years old and realizing, okay, this is not the house. I don't even recognize my own home anymore, you know? And her parents really, their alcoholism kind of just took hold at that time. And it really became pretty awful from what I understand from her and her sisters. And so I think that that's really obviously confusing, because this is a woman who was raised on storytelling and was raised on what is the story, what is the narrative. And so she writes about how confusing this was, that her mother was both this goddess that they admired, and then she also became sort of a nightmare. And so, like, how do you reconcile those two things? And so I think for her, going through that and then working through it in therapy and obviously writing through it over years and years, informs a lot of her decisions in filmmaking and also in who she was as a writer and certainly as a mother. I think she really genuinely wanted to be sure that she was present for her boys and, you know, loving and warm and all the things that she kind of wished she'd had. She writes about that a lot in a lot of her essays. And if I could, I'd love to read a short excerpt from her essay called The Legend. Because I think it's really perfect for this conversation. So a little setup before I get into it. So Nora's parents, again, they're master storytellers. So there's a little bit of debate as to what's truth, quote unquote, which again is something she kind of questioned her whole life. You know, well, what is, how do we know what the truth is? There's all these versions of truth. But there was this wonderful story that her mother loved to tell them about when a writer named Lillian Ross had come for a party at their house. And she basically questioned Phoebe, Nora's mom, about whether or not she actually was present as a mom. What, you know, like, how is it possible you have four daughters and yet you're also, you know, writing full time? And so that's kind of the backstory to this short excerpt. So that was the legend of my mother and Lillian Ross. My mother loved to tell it. It was practically a cowboy movie. We'd been raised to believe that a woman could do everything, and Lillian Ross had dared to question it in our house. So my mother threw her out. I loved this story. I loved all stories that proved that my mother was right and everyone else was wrong, especially since there was a piece of me that couldn't help wishing she was exactly like everyone else's mother. It was at least 10 years before I began to wonder about it. Had it ever actually happened? There are all sorts of stories you grow up with, and then you get older, and there's just something about them that doesn't pass the nose test. They're somehow too perfect. And the most nagging part is the coup de grace, the perfectly chosen last line. My father wrote a memoir once, and in it are several completely unbelievable episodes in which he tells people like Daryl Zanuck to go fuck themselves. This legend of my mother and Lillian Ross was in some way a version of those stories. It was too good to be true. So she goes on to talk about how she eventually was able to confirm this story. And so it's really wonderful because she ends by saying, "This is not about Lillian Ross, really. It's about my mother. Long before she died, I'd given up on her. But that night with Lillian Ross, I got her back. I got back the mother I'd idolized before it had all gone to hell. I got back the simple version. She'd thrown Lillian Ross out of our house for all the right reasons. The legend was true." So, you know, that just kind of gives you a little sense of, you know, again, this very conflicted version of her mother that she had to kind of grapple with, you know, from the time she was 30 years old, especially because she didn't have her around to talk to and ask her about it. So, I just love that. I love that she was able to get her back through that story.
Yeah. And yeah, exactly. And just obviously so well written too. What, is that essay in one of her collections?
Yeah, that piece, The Legend, I believe was originally published in Vogue. And then it was included in her 2010 collection, I Remember Nothing and Other Reflections. And I'll just give a quick shout out to that collection because I always, if I have friends who kind of know of her movies but haven't read her essays, I always point to I Remember Nothing, or of course, Heartburn is another great place to start with Nora's writing. So,
yeah. Well, actually, that's a great, I was going to ask about Heartburn, because it's a kind of semi-autobiographical, right, would you say, or kind of inspired by her relationship with Carl Bernstein, right?
Yes, I am smiling to my, you can't see me, but I'm smiling to myself about the idea that it's semi-autobiographical, because, you know, everything, all fiction is nonfiction, as she might have said, but that's but true, yeah. But yeah, it's funny. She you know, she changed names here and there. Obviously, she changed, you know, some of the details about things. But by and large, yeah. I mean, Rachel Samstadt is her. She's a journalist. She's a food writer. You know, whose husband steps out on her while she's pregnant with her second baby, and that's certainly exactly what happened to Nora in real life, unfortunately. And so, yeah, I mean, she took what was obviously an excruciatingly painful thing in her life and, you know, as Mike Nichols said, wrote it funny. She, yeah. You know, she cried in real life privately. She was devastated. She was embarrassed. And she really, you know, she really was in love. I think she really wanted and expected and hoped, as we all do, you know, that the marriage would work. But she also knew that even as she was going through it, she could hear her mother's voice, you know, everything is copy. And she could sort of see ahead to say, I'm going to write about this and I'm going to somehow make it funny and it's going to be great and I'm going to survive and I'm going to get through it. And that's exactly what she did. And she, you know, at the time said that she would sort of finance her writing of the book by, you know, rewriting screenplays and things like that. She would often be assigned scripts that needed doctoring, basically, as it's called. So she would work on scripts for a few months, and then she would spend a few months working on Heartburn. And so after 3 years, by 1983, the book was done and out in the world, and it became a bestseller. And before it was even out in the world, Mike Nichols, who she worked with on Silkwood around the same time, was working with on Silkwood, said, you know, I'd like to make this into a movie. So it's like, there you go. She actually did what she set out to do, which was, you know, the practical matter of surviving financially on her own. And also the very personal matter of kind of sticking it to Carl Bernstein and saying, you know, why don't I have a right to talk about what happened? Because it happened, you know?
Right. Yeah. I love that. It's her, you said her mother's line, right? Everything is copy. That's just such a great, great line, obviously. And so true, especially when you're, you know, with a reporter, journalistic mindset. Everything's copy. Everything has a story. And I think she really latched onto that. And like you said, from a young age, I want to backtrack a little bit. And you mentioned her, the influence of her parents, because all of her sisters are writers in some capacity too, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. For better or worse, they all, you know, some of them tried to run and hide from writing, but it came and found them, you know, writing finds us whether we want it to or not.
That's right. Yeah.
So, yes, her sisters are all writers, in their own right, various genres and kinds of writing. And, Delia, the second oldest, Delia, and Nora were very, very close their whole lives. And, you know, when Nora made the transition to directing, she said, I really need to be sure I have backup on my screenwriting. And so she really trusted Delia to come in and have those really, you know, smart, creative ideas to kind of help boost the script. And so that became their way of working for many, many years on many, many scripts. And in fact, they were working on a pilot for HBO when Nora went into the hospital for the final time. She and Delia were writing, and you know, it's just a great example of, you know, when you say everything is copy, and it's such a great line. That is one of those things that I started to really also kind of question as I was writing and researching, because when you really truly think of Nora, the little girl, Nora, the person, not just Nora, the writer that we adore, you know, what must that have felt like for her to be told that instead of, you know, it's okay to have feelings that are, you know, sad or mad, or, you know, it was basically kind of like a way of sort of brushing it under the rug. And so, you know, when you think about it like that, you think, huh, you know, like, how did that inform her way of being, you know, and interacting with the world? And Delia writes about this and talks about this so hilariously and beautifully in some of her work. You know, she explained that while Nora had seen her mother for one of the last times in the hospital, and she said, "You're a reporter, take notes," she had actually told Delia the opposite. She had told Delia, you know, what happens here stays here. This is a, you know, this is our family's private business. And so Delia was very confused by this. You know, it's like, okay, so I'm getting one version of mom, you're getting another. And what does it all mean? You know? And so I just, you can start to see again how they kind of each found these unique ways of coping personally and professionally, you know, both as daughters of successful screenwriters and as their own people, you know, navigating through the world. And so I just think that it's really interesting that that was the thing, you know. And so it's been really fascinating to watch Nora's sons, both of whom are very successful in their own right. Jacob is a reporter at the New York Times, and Max, her youngest, is a musician with Taylor Swift. And so,
oh, wow.
Yeah. And so they both obviously grew up with this idea from their grandmother and their mother. And so it's just been interesting to see, you know, how they've navigated that. And Jacob really has a really interesting discussion about it in his documentary, Everything is Copy. Because he, again, he's kind of questioning that, you know, and it's, and curious about it. And so it's pretty interesting, to imagine what it must've felt like to be living your life and then seeing it on Broadway or seeing it in a film and, you know, and yet you're still living it. So pretty interesting.
Yeah, no doubt. In what ways do you think like her personal life either impacted her writing, and or in what ways did she sort of use writing to kind of process, like, I guess, what was happening in her life at different times?
Yeah, no, definitely. I love it because I think this kind of brings us full circle, you know, to the top where we're talking about, you know, her being, you know, 2 years old and her parents are using her material. I think that, and also how I first came to Nora and her work, because again, I was curious about how is this woman all of these things, you know, how is she same person who's, you know, writing very scathing sort of controversial, essays and, you know, kind of dispatches from the women's movement to the same woman who wrote Sleepless in Seattle. I'm like, that doesn't, how, what, you know? And so when I spoke to, you know, people who were close with her, you know, it really was a reflection of her own experiences and her own changing and evolving views on love and life and what's possible. And so she, you know, was married 3 times. And when she met essentially the love of her life, Nick Pileggi, in the late 80s, she had been coming off of The Making of Heartburn. They kind of knew of each other here and there before they actually, quote unquote, met, kind of like a When Harry Met Sally situation where it took 12 years for them to actually both be unattached and go on a date. But basically, that was it. You know, she was completely in love. She was so happy. She was so confident and secure in the fact that she was finally with someone who really allowed her to be her. And so to watch that evolve off screen as she was kind of writing, rewriting Sleepless, actually, it was a rewrite she was assigned to for that, writing You've Got Mail. And then, of course, with Delia. And then, of course, finally with Julie and Julia, really see this influence of Nick and his just incredible unconditional love for her and her incredible affection and unconditional love for him. And so it's really wonderful and special because you can trace, you can watch all of her movies and read her essays and her plays, not knowing her about her life. But once you do, there's so much richer, you know, they're so robust and wonderful. And you start to see all of these themes emerge and you start to see the influence of Phoebe and how she really came to be her own person who realized I can both give and accept love fully, which I think is just such an incredible, incredible thing.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Yeah. In what ways do you think, like, you know, like you said, you can see how her life changed and you can see that in her work, another facet of it. In what ways do you think her work changed either your life or kind of culture in general? I think, you know, rom-coms as a film genre owe a lot to her, I think. I'm wondering if you could speak to that as well.
Yeah, I mean, she had such a singular, specific way of writing, no matter the genre. You can tell it's Nora. She just had such a specific, funny, smart voice. So it can be a recipe or a blog post, and yet you still pretty quickly know that that's who that is.
Yeah.
You know, and she writes about the issues that we all face, you know, finding love, keeping it, what it means to be a woman, what it means to be a wife, a mother, a sister, a friend. And then how to reinvent yourself if and when needed. You know, and not to be afraid of that. And I think that to me, that's like the ultimate feminist move is to just say, like, it's okay. You can change your mind, right. You know, like how freeing that is to just think, okay. And so like you kind of mentioned earlier, she had these robust characters, which now if you think about it and you trace back, a lot of her film protagonists are writers. She really admired other writers and she loved to have her characters be writers. But, you know, she really, you know, throughout her life and throughout her writing, I think gave us all that gift of, you know, we don't need to dumb it down. And so I think, you know, it, like you said, it doesn't have to be a one-dimensional character.
Right.
And yet one of the really interesting things about her is that she's a very smart businesswoman. She knew that she was operating within a system. You know, she had been raised in Hollywood, so to speak. You know, she grew up in Beverly Hills. And so she was very aware of the fact that I'm making this move into movies. And if you want people to come see them, they need to have X, Y, and Z thing that happens. You know, for example, you know, I mean, the original version of When Harry Met Sally, they don't get together. And she had many, many screenplays that were never made, you know, that were really about grittier, more difficult, challenging material that weren't sort of the boy meets girl type situation. But she also, again, like she thought that was both funny and interesting that that is what we all love. 'Cause she loved movies like that growing up, you know, she talks about being a little girl and being literally introduced to Cary Grant after seeing him up on the screen with her mother at a screening in Westwood. And so, you know, you realize she thinks it's hilarious that she too, this very smart, witty, intellectual New Yorker was also kind of brought to her knees, if you will, by these, these sort of, you know, silly, sappy movies. She thought that was pretty funny. And so I think that, what that means to all of us now is, again, she was kind of like, why can't there be, you know, why can't it be a successful movie that also makes us think about things, you know,
right.
Or that has references to my former self, you know, as an essayist and things like that.
Huh.
So it's pretty fun once you start to recognize and realize these parts of these seemingly simple movies are actually pretty complex. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah. And done so well from a writing standpoint, and so just like bitingly funny, like, you know, cuts through everything, I feel like.
And she did have, I hesitate to say it, but she did have a few flops, you know. She that's another thing that I think, again, kind of emerges when you really look at her work over the years. She was incredibly successful, and her writing came to her easily, and it also didn't at times, you know.
Right.
She was very, very dedicated to her craft. She was very disciplined about writing every morning. Nick would say he'd hear her tapping away early after getting her coffee. And, you know, she was very determined to make things good and to make things better. But sometimes ultimately they were misunderstood, or they weren't received as well as she'd hoped. She had this wonderful play about Lillian Hellman and Mary McCarthy called Imaginary Friends. And she writes in her essay about flops that, you know, she hoped that at the end of her life, someone would say, "We're reviving your play," you know, because she felt like it was the best thing she'd ever written. And so I think that there were times that, sometimes her work was ahead of its time. And I think that kind of gets at one of your other questions, which is, you know, about why does her work resonate today? Mm-hmm. She kind of existed in this cool, like, kind of alternate, you know, universe, in the sense that her writing was very specific to the time. And then it also, a lot of times, was kind of forward thinking. And so sometimes audiences weren't necessarily ready for it.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. I love that you brought up that question, because that would be my next question. I think, to me, you know, like you mentioned too, you know, themes of you know, searching for love and trying to keep it, and then also, and like learning about your oneself, you know, that sort of process of self-discovery is timeless. You know, everyone is constantly doing that. Are there any essays that you think resonate, or, you know, or articles like from her time as a journalist that would perhaps resonate differently than when they were first published today, if they came out today?
One thing that comes to mind is two things that come to mind from her screenwriting would be This Is My Life, which was her directorial debut. And it's really about a single mother and her two daughters. And so that, I think, would absolutely be received very differently today and very well. And unfortunately, it's very hard to find. So that's like a project of mine to make sure that people can see that film. I think also Michael was another kind of surprise sleeper hit that she wrote directed, and it came out in 1996 with John Travolta as kind of the slob angel, which she and Delia both thought was really funny, you know.
Yeah.
That we have these idealized versions of angels, and so they really, again, I think that movie now, when I was talking to people about, you know, those who were there making it with her at the time, it's so interesting to watch it in the context of the pandemic and everything else that we've all been through in the last year or two, because, like, the worst possible thing you could say about it is that it's too earnest and too hopeful, you know, like, it's like, you know what I mean? Like, it's like nothing bad really happens, you know, really to anyone. I mean, like, there's obviously some, like, sort of funny quirks and things that happen in that movie. But the point is, like, you know, it's about love and home and what it means to be home, and it's just wonderful. Like you watch it and you turn it off and you're like, oh, I feel better, a little bit better about the world, you know? And so, nice. I guess I just think that, you know, like you kind of said it at the beginning, which is that all of her movies really have that impact on us still. And sometimes it's kind of like even more so today, we kind of are yearning for that person to come and tell us it'll all be all right. And I feel like she's that person. And the reason that it's still works with many, many of the world's like most successful, most famous people, you know, from Steven Spielberg to Barry Diller to, you know, Amy Pascal, and then for the rest of us, is that it's informed by real life. You know, she's not just telling us these sort of silly platitudes to make us feel better. Like these are things that she knows to be true because of this, this, and this, and she's reported on it and she's taken the time to research it. And so you get this feeling of, okay, well, if Nora thinks it's going to be okay, then it's probably going to be okay. And I just think that's the best. That's the best. That's Nora.
Yeah. I love that. That's if Nora says it's going to be okay, it's going to be okay.
That's right. And one of the coolest things about getting to write this book was, you know, getting to talk to people who really, you know, were close with her and still hear her voice, you know, in their heads and still feel that so deeply, you know, that they miss her so much, but they also feel her presence in what they're doing and what they're thinking and seeing and saying, because she was just such a force, you know? And so it's really special to be able to even just, you know, tangentially get to experience that. Yeah.
That is neat. Yeah. And that's the sort of a testament to her as a person, just beyond as a writer, you know, her impact just as Nora Ephron human being, you know?
Absolutely.
I mean, I have a few more questions for you. And one is you mentioned, you know, our current times, you know, we're 2 years into a pandemic, all of the social upheaval, just unrest everywhere. Everyone's anxious and stuff. How do you think if she were alive today? You might not be able to answer this one. Who knows? But how do you think she'd be engaging with our current world that we're in now?
Yeah, I love this question because I did get to talk to a few people about this, and she obviously would have had many, many thoughts about the Trump administration you know, all of the news of the day. She was really the person that you'd call, and she'd have that perfect, smart, witty quip about it, you know. I think she'd be outraged and annoyed by the Roe v. Wade situation that's happening. But I think that, again, ultimately her message is the same, which is, find a way through it, you know, find a way to get through it. And again, to acknowledge that life can be messy. It's not that it's going to be easy and perfect. It's just, even when it's messy, there's a way to see through it. You just have to kind of find it.
I always like to ask this question. Again, it's pure conjecture, so who knows, but like in the early beginning of the pandemic, you know, when quarantine was much stricter, how do you think she would have passed those early pandemic hours? Would she be into puzzles, baking bread? What?
Oh my gosh, what a fantastic question. Yes. All of the above. She would be, you know, I mean, she would be cooking and baking. She would be writing. She absolutely was addicted to this words game that was kind of like a predecessor to Words with Friends. And so she was very addicted to this. She loves Scrabble. I mean, writing, and again, I'm sure. Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that. That's so great. I love this because she, again, would have had like the perfect explanation, you know, of like, here's what we should all be doing, you know? And so often in the last few years, especially since Trump was elected in 2016, there are these articles of people saying, you know, who would know what to do is Nora Ephron, you know? And it's like, it's so true. I mean, she just had that way. But I think that brings up another kind of fascinating piece of information about Nora, which is that her philosophy of life, her philosophy on how to live, you know, not just like to survive, but how to live, really didn't change with her diagnosis of learning she had this blood disorder around 2005, 2006. She really had already been embracing this idea of enjoying the simple things and like what is going to make today a good day kind of thing, which is really kind of cool and special in its own way, because obviously once she did have that diagnosis, even more so, she could see these things. But again, it's just that really wonderful, cool reminder of a walk in the park, the perfect custard from Shake Shack or whatever her thing was. Yeah. Like, this is, you know, this is the thing that makes today a good day. She really appreciated those things. And it's just a great reminder for all of us that obviously through the pandemic, there's been so much pain and anxiety and a lot of loss, but yet there's also been this rebirth and remembering of the simple things, like you said, like people started baking bread from scratch or whatever the things were that are very kind of Nora-esque in their you know. And so I love that you brought that up. I think that's really, really cool and important.
I love that. I think you're totally right. Yeah, her approach would, like you said, was she was already doing it. It's just finding that little thing that makes the day great. I have one more. I didn't prep you with this one, so apologize in advance. But the thought came to me, and it's a fun one. Don't worry. as we were talking about how much, or you were talking about how much Nora loved food, and you know, she's a big foodie, and how much she So if you had the chance to host Nora Ephron for dinner, what would you cook her?
Oh dear, no. No, I would have to order. I would have
Or where would you take her? Yeah.
That's right. There you go. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Can you imagine? You know, I'm picturing, you know, Amy Adams playing Julie Powell in Julie and Julia.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. This,
you know, potentially having Julia Child come over and she's like, what do I cook? I mean, that's kind of what it's like. It's like she's just an absolute legendary cook. She's a legend. I mean, I would go to her recipes and I would see what things she recommends as far as this is the place to buy it, this is not the thing to cook, because that's a very specific thing that she says.
That's right.
You have to be careful though, because see, she would not like it when people would sort of say, well, I'm just going to cater it. She's like, that's ridiculous. We can, you know, so you wouldn't want to have it catered per se. But yeah, I mean, she's so specific about her recommendations, you know, whether it's a particular, pastrami sandwich or, you know, an 8 & Out's hot dog or, you know, the custard she loved from Wisconsin or whatever the things are. I guess I would just do a ton of research and try to find the perfect menu. Yeah.
Well, is there anything else that we didn't cover about Nora or yourself or anything else that you'd like to share with us?
I don't think so. I think that I would just point to her wonderful recommendations about life. And one of them being, again, that she really believed that you should have many, many desserts, not just one. And I think that that's a lovely way to think about life, you know, that there's all these options and embrace them. And I'm just so excited that hopefully a whole new generation of fans and writers and filmmakers will learn more about Nora and her work. I think that, you know, it's important. She's given us so much and so much material, and I'm just really grateful to get to share what she's given us with the world.
Yeah. Well said. I like that. And I am grateful. We're grateful that you wrote a biography about her.
Thank you.
Nora Ephron, a biography, and it comes out June 7th, you said?
Yep. June 7th. Exactly. Yep.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you can pre-order it. We'll have a link in our on our website for you to pre-order this as well. Thank you again, Kristen, for taking the time to do this with me. I really enjoyed the conversation. Yeah, and can't wait to read the book.
Me too. Thank you so much. This was so much fun.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. If you would like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.